Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We've gone into depth in past shows with guests Dr. Connie Zweig and Laura Shapira, discussing the various aspects of Carl Jung's psychological theory of the human shadow as critical components to recognize within. We also spoke with Jungian analyst Gary Bobroff about the consequences of suppressing exploration of your human shadow. Well, Gary joins us today to talk about his research on archetypes, called Archetypal Nature. This is a unique system he's formatted using the psychological insights of Dr. Carl Jung and Antonia Wolf. Gary's Archetypal Nature system can help an individual to have tremendous insight into their psyche, realize their potential, their shadow, and gather a better sense of who they are. The story behind archetypal nature starts with Dr. Carl Jung, who was born in 1875 in Basel, Switzerland. He was a medical doctor and psychiatrist. However, as Gary Bobroff points out, archetypal nature also traces its roots directly back to the deep psychological insight of Antonia Toni Wolf. Early in her life, she was a patient of Jung's, and later became one of the most respected of the early Jungian analysts. Gary Bobroff is the author of Jung, Crop Circles, and the Reemergence of the Archetypal Feminine, a book that applies Dr. Carl Jung's theories as a lens to examine the beautiful and strange crop circle phenomena. He joins us in this interview to talk about archetypal nature. Gary, welcome back to In Other News.
It's great to be here with you, Jeff.
You're working on an interesting new project called Archetypal Nature. Can you tell listeners about this and where the system came from?
Yes, thank you. Archetypal Nature is was originally observed by Toni Wolf, and Toni Wolf was a close companion of Carl Jung. And when they were working on what Jung would publish as his book Psychological Types, or what we know as Personality Type, after they completed work on that, they observed that something was still missing. And that is where we use the term archetype to refer to that piece that was missing. And it really had to do with our deepest, what Toni called the structural forms of the personality. So the deepest layers by which we find our identity, our fulfillment and satisfaction. So, you know, initially Jung wrote in Psychological Types about extroverts and introverts and feeling types and thinking types. And the archetypal nature piece has to do with the whole other piece on top of all that.
Gary, what are the archetypes that you're using in your system here?
Well, what defines archetypal nature is not the archetypes themselves, but the polarities, that there's a natural system in the psyche of opposition between archetypal qualities. So on the north end of our archetypal chart, which is north-south axis with a circle around it, at the top, we have folks that are oriented towards the collective whole of their human world, the people in their group sense, their family, their work family, their business, their culture, their tribe, their group of friends in the social sense. And we refer to those folks as king, queen, or mother, father archetype. And the axis that runs down north-south is called the personal axis, because all these folks are interested in people. But on the south end, it's interested in people in their one-on-one quality. So romantic interaction, personal, intimate, friendship, one-on-one. And our energy just flows in these directions unconsciously. So myself as a seeker, I'm very interested in romantic relationships and a one-on-one. And my energy just flows there. I don't have to make it flow there. It just does. My unconscious flows in that direction. And I find myself thinking about, you know, romantic partners or friendships one-on-one. Now, if you're someone who identifies with king, queen, or mother, father, your energy is going to flow down into how is this individual fitting into the group? What's the hierarchy here? Who's where on this totem pole? And that's very different. And so we talk about that group-oriented archetype folks in terms of the king and queen and mother, father, because they are group oriented. Their energy is interested in how you fit into the whole. And we also can understand them by the interest in doing for others. So they really want to be of service. They want to take care of. And this can be very wonderful, and it's lovely to be nurtured and cared for. But the shadow of that can also be control. So that there's, you know, we're going to care for you, but, you know, you better be on our team. On the south end with seeker companion, it's very lover-child archetype. It's very kind of play-oriented and flowing and tends to be more unorthodox and non-traditional and interested in one-on-one with other individuals and the new and the unique and bringing the pieces of our culture that are, you know, unrecognized into the light. And there's an inherent tension between these two pieces because the top ends, the mother and father, are very much interested in belonging. Do you belong? Are you one of us? Versus the seeker companion, the lover archetype folks that really want to be free from belonging. They want to be free of their parental expectations or the family expectations. You know, you find a lot of folks, you know, that move from the, you know, what you might call the Midwest to the West Coast are going to be a lot of the seeker companion folks that want to break free from perhaps a stifling family environment. But you do find these archetypes in many, many non-traditional forms in many, many ways. You know, you can have a punk who's father archetype or a hippie who's father archetype and vice versa. So we use the kind of cartoony examples to help people understand it, but the more you understand it, the easier it is to see the nuance and the subtlety and to get clear on who's what. Now, the other axis runs east-west, and this axis is on the western side called warrior and Amazon, and on the eastern side called sage and mediatrix or magician and mediatrix. And the warrior and Amazon are definitely about doing and performance and excellence. And the magician and sage and mediatrix is about the inner world of apprehension, comprehension, understanding. But both of those folks, that's impersonal. They're interested in ideas or doing. They're not necessarily interested in people. And one of my partners in this archetypal work has worked with a client who's an Olympian, a world champion athlete, and they were extremely warrior. And they didn't have a lot of energy flowing into the personal axis. They were really consumed with the doing well of the warrior and were not finding their energy flowing into relationships, and they had a lot of problems in that area. And the magician, the sage mediatrix archetype folks, too, can have that as well, where they're just wrapped up in their ideas and reading and studying and that sort of thing and miss relationships. So the potency and the tension in the system is quite strong because not only do you have a tension between the warrior who wants to do and the magician who wants to know and understand, but you have a tension between the father and the seeker and between the group and the individual. And when you really get this whole picture, you see that a lot of the tension in our society and a lot of the unspoken questions and unconscious dialogues that are going on in our society.
Can you tell listeners who Toni Wolfe is and about her work with Carl Jung?
Sure. Toni Wolfe was initially Jung's patient, and he cured her, apparently. And she became Jung's kind of other wife. She was his mistress, and there was a very open relationship between Carl Jung. And in fact, it was so open that, and she was so deeply involved in his work and became a Jungian analyst in her own right. And she was the first president of the Zurich Psychological Club, which is like the first Jung Institute. In the foyer of that building was a portrait of Jung on one wall, a portrait of Toni Wolfe on another wall, and a portrait of Emma Jung on the third wall. And so it was very well understood that these three people were all contributing to what, you know, today we call Jungian psychology. When Jung allowed himself to descend into the unconscious, which produced the Red Book period, Toni was there as his kind of psychic lifeguard to really help him through that. And she was so able to do that and was so gifted in that area that so gifted in helping Carl Jung with psychology and as an analyst in her own right that when she died, Emma Jung, Carl's wife, said, you know, thank God for Toni Wolff, you know, that she could never have done for him what she did, what Toni did. So quite remarkable.
Gary, you pointed out the archetypal nature traces its roots directly back to the work of Antonia Wolff. Why exactly does it point directly back to her work?
She was the first person to really observe this and set this archetypal structure forward. You know, she was working with it probably for decades before she put it out there in the 40s. But this kind of terminology and the observance of these archetypes in our lives really did come directly through Toni Wolff. You know, Toni Wolff was in this relationship with Jung and Emma Jung, and part of why she discovered this archetypal nature piece was that she could see that Emma was a very different archetypal kind of person than she was. Their archetypes were quite different. The way that they find their deepest satisfaction in the world was very different from Emma than it was with Toni. So Toni was the first person to really see this in the world and codify it and put this series of opposites that define archetypal nature together.
I'm really interested in Toni's work a little bit. Now, you have a reference of her book on your website titled The Structural Forms of the Feminine Psyche. Why is that important to this realm of archetypal nature?
It's the first time that this really was ever put forward by anyone. You know, Toni observed these archetypes at work in the psyche of herself and her patients and the other people that were around her. And so she was really the first person to put it out there. And most of the work that Toni did was one-on-one with clients, one-on-one as an analyst. Her work is found in the other, in my book on crop circles as well. So it's kind of funny to me that the two pieces of Jungian psychology that I'm carrying forth are really related to Toni Wolff. But, you know, most of what she didn't publish a lot. You know, structural forms of the feminine psyche is a transcript of her presentation at the sort of opening of the first Jung Institute, a presentation she gave. So she didn't publish much. She really worked with clients. And this is one of the few pieces that we have of Toni Wolff in terms of written material that has been carried forward from that time.
This area you've been studying for at least 20 years, you've researched this area of archetypal nature, and you put together a very interesting presentation. Can you give a couple examples, I suppose, of the king, queen, mother, father type in the world?
Yeah, I think a lot of folks would understand king, queen, mother, father in terms of doing for. So these are people that are finding satisfaction out of doing for other people. So, for example, you know, like I said, the teacher would be one example. Another example that would be careers that we really, you have to be motivated by service to undertake them. So firefighting, for example. You know, the other axis on the system runs east-west, and on the western edge is warrior Amazon, and on the eastern edge is sage Mediatrix. And the people that find satisfaction through warrior really are about doing, about performance, about accomplishing in the outer world, about the satisfaction of a job well done. And on the other end, with the sage and magician, those folks are interested in, you know, comprehension and understanding and knowing and the inner kind of excellence. Now, when you combine these quadrants on the top left, you get the warrior father. And like I said, with a firefighter, you know, I know some firefighters, and all the firefighters I know are father warrior. You know, they're really about physical fitness, about service to their community, and they've chosen that career to honor those values. And so that's one example. You know, people that aren't motivated primarily by service are not going to undertake a career like that. And you have to understand that those folks really are about doing for. Now, there's also a shadow quality in all these, and the shadow for the mother, father, king, queen archetype is wanting to control. You know, it's very sticky, this doing for stuff. Well, we're going to do for you, but we also want, you know, this, that, or the other. Or folks are doing stuff for you that maybe you didn't ask them to do. So, you know, nobody's perfect here. We're all coming in with a shadow and with the potential for tremendous, you know, goodness and maturity, too.
I really enjoy this area here to examine. I might ask you, Gary, if that's okay, to maybe explore a few more shadow aspects of the king warrior or the queen warrior here.
You know, the king warrior, that specific combination archetype in the top left side of the archetypal wheel, that's, you know, the archetype that you're going to see in the corporate boardroom, right? Like, you're not going to go in there and find a bunch of seeker magicians, you know, that would rather be off at Burning Man. You know, this in that top left, the king warrior or father warrior, those folks, you know, in the corporate sense, you know, they're going to get to where they are by being responsible, by finding the most prudent and most efficient path forward for their organization, and they're going to be doing that year after year. There is, of course, a shadow there always, and, you know, that shadow can be coldness or cruelty in terms of the warrior and in terms of the father, all kinds of different things. You know, the father is necessarily, you know, a common kind of cartoony example of the shadow of the father. There's two different ones I would give you. From the historic perspective, if your listeners have seen the Frost-Nixon interviews from the 70s or the movie Frost-Nixon, they know that when the President Nixon, after he had left office, was interviewed and David Frost, you know, engaged him in a conversation to the point that he actually said, you know, when the president does it, that means it's not illegal by definition. So that Nixon really was identified with the king. He was identified with power, and he felt that whatever he did, that was by definition a righteous thing to do, a legal thing to do, a good thing to do. And he didn't understand, you know, certainly the American Constitution, but he didn't understand the psychology where you can fall into identification with one of these roles as he had. And so that's a big problem where you're identified with power, but the king can also, or the father can also, from a shadow place, be very resistant to the new growth, the individuality that is represented by the seeker-lover archetype at that South Pole. Those that are interested in the individual and the new and the unique and the unconventional. You know, there's a million TV shows that are about this, but the absolute classic would be your Archie Bunker, you know, where he is really old school and proud of it and steeped in it. And, you know, that whole show is really about his struggle to deal with the world that is making room for different archetypes in the 70s. It's making room for people that don't share the father's values. And that's very difficult for some fathers to deal with. But, you know, all these archetypes have a really mature form and an immature form available to them. And in the most mature form, of course, the father can be very wonderful and warm and can bless us and make us tell us that we're a valuable part of the group and make us really feel valued for who we are. And he can do that to every archetype and every person. So I don't want to, you know, by bringing up the shadow of the father, make them out to be all that. I mean, all these archetypes have an equal amount of maturity and shadow qualities available to them.
I know. I agree. I understand that. But I wanted to just get into that area because I feel that those in control, there's a few specific shadow aspects that are abundant right now in our world with those who are in control. Another aspect of the shadow possibly is the manipulative nature of someone who is in control and giving things to people that they didn't ask for, and then having that imbalance take place, and then the person doing the giving is upset because they didn't receive anything in return, but it was unspoken. So that takes place on a lot of different levels, even in politics. And going back to the Frost-Nixon example, can you explain a bit more about why it's important not to link your identity to some of these archetypal traits that you mentioned.
Sure. Well, let me give you an example from the other end of the archetypal spectrum. So the other end from the father and the king is what we call the seeker. And in Jungian psychology, the two archetypes behind seeker would be lover and child. And you know, there's shadow and good qualities with that. The child in Jungian psychology is the thing that brings the new, things that brings the new quality that the society needs. And the lover, of course, you know, enjoys that the one-on-one and all that. But you can get lost in that. And part of the shadow there, right, is a Peter Pan quality that never settles down or never really comes down to earth. And one of the examples we talk about in the workshop with that is Michael Jackson. And he, of course, is very identified with Peter Pan and really exemplifies that in the negative way, that he was disconnected from the world and lived in a kind of a fantasy disconnection, Never Neverland, on his Never Neverland ranch. And, you know, that's very dangerous because, you know, one of the fundamental questions that comes out when you explore this work for a while is that there's an essential tension in our society between belonging and freedom from belonging, between It's a Wonderful Life and Jack Kerouac's On the Road.
Yes.
You know, the tension that wants to bring us into society, make us adapt to society, and the part of us that wants to be free from that society. And as a seeker, you know, we can drift too far from shore. We can wander away from the things that would ground us and bring us back into life and are healthy for us. And we can, you know, be sort of endlessly evolving. There's a great scene in The Big Chill where William Hurt's character talks about, you know, not finishing his dissertation and, you know, I'm evolving, I'm still evolving, and this sort of endless process of growth and are never really coming into firm form and the kind of form that you need to be in to participate in society. And a big part of that movie is about that dynamic, about bringing William Hurt's character into a fold of healthy relating to other humans and, you know, being a part of a group. And I think that's a big tension in our society, especially in this kind of technological age where we are less and less involved in a face-to-face way, potentially, with people. So.
Yes, that has a lot of shadow potential there, and it's definitely playing out right now. And you mentioned in a previous conversation, whenever you're on this circle, you tend to project your values on other people, that they should be like you. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so anywhere on the outside of the circle, we tend to think that everybody should be like us. So if we're identified with the warrior, and we're someone that's really, you know, healthy and fit and out there doing and, you know, being excellent and all that, you know, we assume that everyone should be fit, and that's wonderful, but it's not necessarily a value that other people share. And that's really, you know, up to them to choose their values for themselves. So, you know, if we're someone who's identified with the magician, we think that everyone should be, you know, have the right ideas, and everyone should, you know, look at, you know, this new study that we've seen. And if you just read that, then you'd get it. You know, there's all these different ways. No matter where we sit on the circle, we're going to potentially imagine that everyone should have the values that we have. You know, a lot of our political stuff has to do with this as well. There's, you could say that the underneath the words of our political left-wing, right-wing stuff is a tension between father warrior and seeker magician folks. You know, the seeker magician is constantly coming up with new ideas. You know, I often say that the left-wing has a Lisa Simpson complex, that they think the smartest person in the room should just be president. They should just be made president. They shouldn't have to go through the struggle of actually campaigning. And there's a lack of understanding that, you know, politics is a warrior sport and it's a competition for power. It's not about debate and who has the best ideas, but the magician would very much like it to be that because that's where they're comfortable. You know, and the left tends to bring a knife to a gunfight over and over again. from that point of view. And I think there's a lot for all of us to learn about the relativity of these archetypes, and that, you know, each of us is sitting in this different archetypal place and looking around at the other ones and expecting everyone to think like we do. You know, if your father is a father archetype person, you, and you're a seeker person, you're focused on one-on-one, you may want to have a late night heart-to-heart drink and conversation with him. Now, he may want you to be at Christmas dinner with your family and with the rest of the family there so that he can see that he is a good king, that he's got all his tribe lined up in order and everyone's provided for and happy. And those are completely different things that we want from life.
I want to stop you there for a second. Regarding these particular archetypes, and actually all of them, the importance of learning about these in terms of who you are and who maybe somebody else is in your world, in your life, such as a family member, and then understanding that that's who they are and they probably won't change from that archetype. Is that important to know?
Yeah, I mean, to really understand that you are the archetype you're going to be. There's different archetypal systems out there, and people believe a lot of different things. And there's some folks say, well, you know, you're going to do your magician stage and then you're going to do your warrior stage and all this and that and the other. And I don't believe that. And I've never seen that in reality. What I have seen is that people are essentially what they are. They may mature and their archetype will become less cartoony. People that are really, really mature, they tend to, and I don't mean old, I mean psychologically mature, and those things are only theoretically correlated. People that are really mature, figures in our, you know, in American history that are really exceptional, can be difficult to tell their archetype because, unless you know their background, their personal life, because they tend to speak to everyone. They tend to, you know, look at great presidents. They tend to speak to everyone's values. But all of us really are coming from one or two archetypes, you know, usually a personal and an impersonal one. You know, we're coming from the place where we are, and we're not going to magically transform into someone else. We're not going to turn into another archetype. You know, Carl Jung, who's one of my heroes, he was a seeker magician. He didn't magically turn into father archetype in the second half of his life. In fact, he went even more into being a magician and more into being a seeker, more and more into the world of ideas and the world of exploring the psyche one-on-one with other people. You know, he was less and less interested in the collective institutions and society and that sort of thing, although he was interested in the world in general. So it's really important to understand that each of us is coming from a place, and it's very freeing to acknowledge and accept and understand that these are the one or two archetypes that I come from, and you're not going to be everything, that everyone isn't going to be all the archetypes, that we're all not going to be perfect in all these ways. One of the really magical things that happens at the workshops is that people drop the illusion that they're supposed to be everything. Very commonly, women that are not mother archetype will come and say, geez, it's so wonderful to not have to expect all of my satisfaction in life to come through mothering. And of course, that's just one archetype. You know, that's just one way of being in the world. It's important to own your place that you're coming from and say, this is my archetype, and I'm not going to be all these other things in the world. And then you can move forward and be a little happier and drop some of the expectations that you have for yourself to try and be everything to everyone.
Thanks for explaining that. I think that could be very freeing. Our guest is Gary Bobroff. We're talking about his recent work called Archetypal Nature. We'll be right back after this break.
Thank you.
Gary Bobroff is our guest. He's the author of Young Crop Circles and the Reemergence of the Archetypal Feminine. But we're speaking with him about his work called Archetypal Nature. Now, we went through the mother-father type at the top of the axis, and then the south, that's north and south, is the seeker-companion, lover archetype. Then the west is the warrior or Amazon. Now, we didn't mention the east. If we can go over that briefly.
Sure. Yeah, the east-west axis in general is what we call the impersonal axis. And that axis is about, you know, the things that are not about human beings in reality. So on the west end is the warrior, and on the east end is magician or sage and mediatrix. And the sage mediatrix archetype is really interested in comprehension, in understanding, in the inner world. You know that your mechanic is a sage archetype when, after he fixes your car, he tells you, oh, I had to go and drill a little hole in this part here, make that fit, and he tells you all the detail about how he had to go and really, you know, do a special job for you and how that all worked. You can find these archetypes in lots of different forms and lots of different ways, but the magician or sage or mediatrix is really about that inner understanding, the inner excellence, the inner knowing, truth, you know, the inner world, psychology, ideas, all of that.
Gary, this area of archetypal nature, a lot of people did incredible research to arrive at this. And can you tell us about that research and who was involved and how long it took?
Well, really, I mean, the thing with archetypal nature is that it was a part of the language to Jungian psychology for a long time. It was really around the time that they wrote the personality type work that they really discovered this archetypal piece, Tony Wolf and Carl Jung. And that became a part of the language of Jungian psychology from around 100 years ago into the 70s and 80s was still quite commonly spoken of. And there were people that carried that work forward in the traditional form. There was an American-Canadian couple called Tad and Noreen Guzzi who carried the work forward in their book About Men and Women in the 70s and 80s and 90s, doing workshops with it and a great book about it. But then since then, and it's kind of the message has been lost somewhat in the Jungian world. And so that's why I'm working to bring this back, because there is such tremendous depth here, and people really do relate to it. You know, they really relate to understanding themselves through this lens and understanding other people. You know, if you're dealing with someone that's a warrior, you know, you're not going to be very happy if you're expecting them to respond to magician approaches.
I guess I would want to ask this, get a little more detail on this answer. In terms of text and specific writings and specific areas for people who wanted to maybe look back into the research.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's going to be super fruitful. I mean, basically it comes down to, you know, the writings on archetypal nature are structural forms of the feminine psyche and about men and women. And those are the two only direct books that are about it. There's other books that mention it a little bit. There's, you know, Moore and Gillette's King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, but that's a very different system. They're talking about, you know, everybody needing to develop their warrior, everybody needing to develop their king. They're not really emphasizing identification of people in one or two archetypes. So in terms of exactly about, you know, the tradition that I'm carrying forward in terms of writing is, the you know, Tony Wolf and the Guzzies, and that's it.
I wondered about that. So these are fixed archetypes that people essentially fall into at birth, and you probably won't change from your particular archetype from this analysis. We probably won't be synthesizing into various other archetypes, as others point out in those other books.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you know, there's a lot of archetypal books out there. Caroline Mace, Carol Pearson, Robert Moore, and I really like Robert Moore and Douglas Gillette's work on archetype. And I definitely reference it in my workshops, and it's powerful work. But I think the thing that a lot of those workshops are doing, and you can go online and take a Find Your Archetype questionnaire, but that is not anywhere near the psychological depth of this work. And one of the fundamental differences start with the fact that they're saying, you know, for example, in Carol Pearson's work, well, you go in this stage and then you go in that stage and you did the magician and now you're doing the warrior and this, that, and the other. And in my experience, I don't find people completely change their archetypal, identification in the world. You don't live a decade of your life, being constantly obsessed with ideas, and then a decade of your life being constantly obsessed with fitness from an inner motivational place. That's not reality. The reality is that all of us come into this world with a kind of an archetypal stamp of one or two pathways that our energy really flows down. We find ourselves unconsciously thinking about relationships as a seeker, unconsciously being obsessed with ideas. And, like I'm right now speaking to you, I'm a magician seeker. I'm sharing ideas and possibilities with you over the phone and enjoying doing that. And that's just flows for me naturally and easily. I'm not going to mature one day into being a father archetype and being very interested in the country club and charity work and all that. I might get somewhat more interested in that. I might, tend to become a little more interested in it, but I also might just deepen into the archetypes that are a part of me today. And I think it's important to drop the notion of these archetypes as stages. They're, in my experience, they're not stages. They're pieces of our identity that aren't going to change over time.
This is getting really interesting because I suspect this is what your work in helping people gets them to understand where they're at in terms of their own archetype. And and I suppose that can be really fulfilling for an individual. Now, you're doing a webinar on archetypal nature that's coming up in March. Can you tell listeners about that?
Yeah, they can find out more about it at archetypalnature.com. And we're doing a webinar starting on March 14th. It's 4 weeks. And we really take you slowly through it and introduce these archetypes, and so you can really get it for yourself. Then as we deepen into it, we start to explore the psychology of it and the way that, all of us are different, the shadow pieces here. As a seeker magician, I look to the top left corner there, the father warrior, and I can see my own shadow. And how do we find our own, personal journey through that? So, we get into that as we go deeper into the webinar. But it starts March 14th, and archetypalnature.com is where you can find out all about it.
Yes. So it's interesting, the other models, as you were pointing out, where you can be a variety of archetypes, don't necessarily give you your shadow aspect. They want you, I suppose, to drift into the center of the quadrant to become a whole person. But
that's exactly right. I mean, I think some of the other models that are out there about archetype, because they're not based on, what Tony Wolf observed was these natural polarities in the psyche. And I think these other systems are essentially just giving you a whole bag full of archetypes and saying, well, figure it out. And when you use this, when you look and discover this, these polarities, these oppositions in the psyche, you can really look and see, okay, my opposite is over here, and I need to work on this and that. It's a much stronger and more potent psychological tool than just a sort of a random collection of archetypes, being that you can read about in a book somewhere.
How does this work help people in their relationships?
Well, I think it's tremendously powerful in relationships because people want such different things. I mean, very often people's first marriage, they'll marry somebody who's opposite archetype. That was certainly my case in my early relationships. We tend to be attracted to our opposite. We tend to be attracted to people that are opposite personality type and people that are opposite archetype. And if you're dating someone that's the opposite archetype of you, you're not going to want to do the same things. If you're, focused on the one-on-one and want to go and have a romantic evening alone and your partner is, you know, a mother-father archetype and they want to do something with a family or a group, you know, those are very different things, and you're not going to find the same level of satisfaction. You know, if you're trying to woo a woman who finds satisfaction through the Amazon archetype, you know, she really sees flirting often within the realm of competition. She wants to go out and have kind of a sporting type date where, you know, you can kind of be sort of razzing each other the whole time. And she wants you to hold that tension of that kind of competitive flirting idea. And so these are very different things. And you, again, it's one of these qualities where if you're just sitting in your archetype, you imagine everyone wants what you do, and you miss that they're inviting you to different opportunities for how to be in the world. And I mean, relationships is one of the biggest things that we can get into with this work, because there's so much room for projection and difference. And, you know, why do you want that and I want this, and why are we so different, and all that is exactly what the work is all about. And that's what we get into.
Yes, it's a lot more detailed than the introvert, extrovert.
Right, exactly.
Okay, you spoke about relationships. What does archetypal nature offer that might be culturally relevant for women?
You know, I think a big thing with women is that they are, you know, sort of expected to be everything, everyone all the time. They're expected to, you know, be the career woman and the lover and the mother and, you know, utterly knowledgeable on everything and, you know, intuitive at the same time. And the fact is none of us are everything. That's not a realistic expectation. And I think particularly given what we call the lover archetype or the companion archetype, letting her see the universal place of this archetype, that it is not any worse than the mother, that the mother is one universal archetype and the companion is another, that quality of doing with, which defines the lover-seeker-companion archetype, that one-on-one interest is just as valuable as the mother who's interested in the family whole. That is just as valuable, and I think it's tremendously powerful for women to be shown that, hey, this is, you know, there's this other role out there that you're probably already finding satisfaction through that is just as valid as, you know, this role of the mother that society says you're supposed to find satisfaction through. The other piece that's very big that we introduce that I think a lot of your listeners will be interested in is the mediatrix. And the mediatrix is that part of us that knows through the unconscious, that knows around corners of time and space, that feels the unspoken thing in the room, that knows the thing that she's not supposed to know. And that role has been in every culture, you know, before modern Western culture, has been given a place and a role. If you look at tribal societies, you look at ancient Greece with Delphi, you know, there was a place for the oracle, for the seer, for the prophetess. And our society, because it's so rational, you know, we've completely, you know, thrown that archetype away, although it is coming back certainly in the last couple decades. And, you know, you see it on TV and the show Medium and stuff like that. To give that woman a place in the system, I think is very important. Say you have a role here, and to show her that this system of nature includes her, I think is very important, and important for the other archetypes to see as well. And you know, that would be two of the big pieces for women. But also, overall, the idea that be happy with the one or two archetypes you are and drop the notion that you're supposed to be everything to everyone all the time.
I can see that could be very freeing to some people.
Yeah.
In your workshop, you use a number of historic film and television examples. What's a notable film example of some of the archetypes?
Oh, there's lots of them. I think really classic ones, you know, certainly, you know, The Godfather is the classic father warrior type. We use tons and tons of movie and TV examples. You know, The Breakfast at Tiffany's movie is an essay on the lover companion archetype, a woman who doesn't want to be put in a cage, that refuses to fall in love because she feels like it's going to be something that, you know, steals her individuality and all that, and is constantly trying on new persona and never settling down into who she really is. You know, that's a complete definition of the lover companion archetype. It's really throughout the work, we throw in tons and tons of movie and TV examples. I think, I mean, one of the most astounding things about this work is that when you look at virtually every movie that we really, really love, it's just archetype central. You know, The Wizard of Oz, you know, he's looking for a heart, the lover, looking for courage, the warrior, looking for a brain, the magician. You know, and here you have Dorothy struggling with no place like home, belonging versus freedom from belonging, and all that kind of tension. You know, all the wizards and you know, witches in that movie. You know, Star Wars, all these kind of Lord of the Rings, all these are thoroughly, thoroughly archetypal, and they're telling us something about who we are. And we love these movies because they are us at our deepest level. And, you know, that's why they are so powerful and so moving for us, because they are deeply archetypal and we are deeply archetypal. And so to engage with those archetypes in a more conscious way, in a more personally truthful way, is what this work is all about. And it's tremendously powerful and freeing, so that we go beyond simply enjoying these movies as a fantasy and begin to use them as ways to understand ourselves and the other people in the world around us for their differences and for their sameness and for their complementary things they're bringing to us that we don't have, and for the gifts that we have that they need. You know, to look at these films in a more conscious way is really, really powerful. And they're, you know, it's ubiquitous. All these films that we love are full of archetype.
Yes, and I imagine that's going to be very interesting in this workshop. And I had a past guest, executive director of the Carl Jung Institute here in New York City, Laura Shapira. She and I were speaking about the human shadow, and she had so much great insight about it. And we were talking about films and movies that depict, you know, the psychological theory, the shadow aspect. And mm-hmm. So we were looking at The Incredible Hulk. You know, what happens? He gets angry and he turns green and destroys, you know, that's his shadow aspect. And then there was a Spider-Man movie, I can't remember what, maybe it was Spider-Man 3, where something attaches to his costume and it turns dark. And he becomes this different person, starts to do things that's out of his likable personality.
Mm-hmm.
Touching on the shadow archetypes a little bit, which I thought was interesting, something I wouldn't have seen before, but once you start looking into this material, you'll start to notice it on the screen and in books and in storylines.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it is everywhere. You know, The Breakfast Club, you know, is completely a teenage archetypal drama. You know, the recent movie, The Wolf of Wall Street, that was just out, you know, shows you the very immature kind of warrior type. But it also, that movie closes on this great scene where, you know, he says, "Sell me this pen." And he's doing a training for folks, and he's trying to get them to sell me this pen. And really what he's doing, and he holds the pen out to this audience of people that are at this training seminar, and they all just have these utterly blank looks on their faces. And what that scene is about, archetypally, is the warrior addressing the magician and trying to tell the magician about what it means to be a warrior and, you know, what it means to go out there and sell that pen. It's not a puzzle. It's not a magician's riddle to solve. It's, you know, about that sort of assertiveness of the warrior, you know, going out there and selling and making a sale is a warrior task. You're trying to get someone to do something. It's power and motivating behavior. As I mentioned, The Godfather is, you know, such a classic example of the father warrior. He's exactly that type. And there's a scene that I show in the workshop, which is the meeting of the five families, which is a much beloved scene where, you know, Brando's character, you know, says, you know, "Hey, we're going to have this peace, but you know, if anything should happen to his son Michael, he's going to blame some of the people in this room. And so what you see there is the father making peace in his community, but also that father warrior who is no fool and who is very explicitly warning everyone there that, you know, I'm not going to, you know, okay, we're going to have this peace, but I'm also a very dangerous person and I'm going to be very, you know, angry with all of you and do something about it if things, you know, if my family is not respected and protected. And so that is a very powerful learning tool for folks that don't have that quality, that aren't father warrior, that don't understand those values. You know, you can look at it as, oh, it's a great movie, but also, you know, there's something that we can all learn from understanding all this psychologically that's very powerful, that, you know, that all these archetypes have a role in the world that can be both positive and negative.
Well, Gary Bobroff, you're bringing forward the traditional material from 100 years ago, basically, and I really look forward to this workshop. Can you tell listeners again when it's going to be and how they can find out more information?
Yeah, it's 4 Saturday mornings beginning March 14th. Archetypalnature.com is the website. They can check it out there.
Gary Bobroff, he's the author of Jung, Crop Circles, and the Reemergence of the Archetypal Feminine. Thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Thank you, Jeff.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again on Dark Matter Radio.
Shaking like a leaf on the desert heat. His daddy's got a bang that's a hard to beat. I bought me a ticket, got a front row seat. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye. Looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come by UFO? Tricks are full in the book I read. Only man I know that got up from the dead. A lot of people living by the words that I said. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye. Looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come by UFO? Think he'll ever come again a different way? Maybe he is coming while I was away. Too much goodness is a sin today. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye. Looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come by UFO? Something happening that isn't too clear. Just a little different than a previous year. I think the happiness is getting very near. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye. Looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come?